Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
Hi everyone, this is Roberto here from Tsar Power. I hope you're doing well. Currently still recovering from my sickness. My voice is much better. However, my throat still hurts when I talk for extended periods of time. And with the case of Tsar Power episodes, that period of time can be a lot sometimes, especially with the next ruler. Just edited myself out coughing there. Anyways, so what I'm coming to say is that I am putting on last year's intelligent speech presentation that I did with Aurora and Benjamin Jacobs on Soviet urbanism. So with that, please listen to it and then also use the code Tsar to get a 10% discount on intelligent speech this year. I'm presenting, we'll be talking about Laika and the Soviet space program, because Laika is the best companion. Let's not talk about what happened to Laika until the presentation. But anyways, there'll be other headliners like Trevor from the History of Persia, Rob and Jamie from Totalis Rankium, and the Alternate Historian from YouTube. So feel free to join us there. Links are in the episode description, and use the code Tsar for a 10% discount. It's going to be on Discord this year, so I know most of you guys already use that. So it'll be nice and easy once I send you all the invites, because guess what? It's me sending them this year. I am in charge of planning this whole conference. So hope to see you guys there and enjoy last year's presentation.
And welcome. My name is Eric. I will be your tech support and I will be moderating the chat for this session. Just a reminder, the session is being recorded. And while I do not work for Zoom, if you are having any issues, please mention it in the chat and I'll do my best to see what I can do to help you. When the session starts, there was roughly about a 20-minute presentation by our presenters and then roughly for a 20-minute Q&A. So as you start forming questions in your head, feel free to put them in the chat or be ready to raise your hand at the bottom of the screen and I can allow you to ask your question there. Just also keep in mind, this is a family-friendly format. So whatever question you do ask, please kind of moderate it to that. And with that said, I will hand it off to our lovely speakers today. Have at it, guys.
All righty. Hello, everyone. My name is Roberto from Tsar Power.
I am Benjamin Jacobs from Wittenberg to Westphalia.
And I'm Aurora from Tsar Power for this presentation.
Awesome. So thank you guys all for joining us today. We are doing a joint presentation with Wittenberg to Westphalia because
Ben is an urban planner, and we're talking about Soviet urbanism here today. But I'm going to do a bit of a focus more on the country of Georgia, and Ben's going to take over from the Soviet Union at that point, because I don't even know so much about urbanism, and this is something that I was given to a while back. So I decided to combine the themes of both my podcasts in the place that they overlap most, and this is the Russian occupation period. So we have some slides here. We can start presenting. So, and I'm still very far off from reaching the Russian occupation period in both the history of Sacramento, Georgia, and we're not even close to the Soviet Union and Tsar power. But this is just a glance at some of the infrastructure stories in the future. I will mention that this idea was given to me by a fan and friend of the show, Konstantina Megalishvili. He also provided me with the cursory information needed to get started, since much of this is locked behind the Georgian language. He's also a history student in Tbilisi, and this information came to him via a cousin who saw it in a dream. But I joke. He did give it to me through with sourcing and valid sourcing at that. Anyways, we're going to go and look into a few things. First of all, what was the Soviet metric to build the metro? We're going to look at a brief history of Soviet metros up to Tbilisi, introduce the anti-hero to our story, Vasil Mizhavanadze, and how he managed to get the Soviets to build the metro in Tbilisi, and then introduce our guest, Benjamin Jacobs, to talk a bit about Soviet urbanism in general. This isn't meant to be a deep look into things, because honestly, that's best for the future, and this is literally a three-paragraph story that I was able to make into something a bit more. So, Aurora, how excited are you about to learn about the metro today?
I love a good metro. Please.
Awesome. So let's start off with what it takes to build a metro according to the Soviets. So we start off with the construction of the Moscow metro in 1935. Moscow, as we know, is the capital of the Soviet Union and was obviously going to be the first place that the Soviets planned to build their metro empire. Planning for the metro system actually started back in the Russian Empire, but was postponed due to something known as the Great War. And then, Aurora, what happened during the Great War?
Only good things, as far as I'm aware. Only cool, good, and fun things, if YouTube is to be, you know, a reliable source.
Yes, because the Soviets took over. There was a revolution in Russia. Spoilers for our podcast. I'm sorry, Aurora.
Oh, no.
Modern history spoiled. And then the train started chugging along. See what I did there. And the Soviets were able to get a plan approved in 1933 for a total route length of 50 miles around Moscow. So they're building a lot of train tracks. Now, there's an important thing to know. And Aurora, can you tell me about how this metro system on screen looks like to you? Is it ugly? Is it beautiful? Is it something in between?
You know, it's a lot shinier and a lot more like really well put together than any metro I've ever used in America. I can tell you that much. You know, I do love the New York City subway system, but it doesn't quite look that shiny.
No, having used the New York City subway system, it looks like absolute garbage compared to this. And I've used the Moscow metro. It is quite nice. But the main reason that the Moscow metro is so beautiful is because the Soviets wanted to showcase this as good communist infrastructure that symbolized progress and use it as both an object of art and public utility. Because you can use things in your day-to-day life and as an everyday thing and keep it beautiful. It doesn't have to be brutalist or, you know, disgusting in either way. I don't like concrete infrastructures. So, and also there was a huge lack of personal transport in the Soviet period. So metros would be in massive demand for the people, as an underground train system would move massive amounts of people in a much more convenient way than building the infrastructure for bus systems, especially in more populous cities. However, the construction of a metro is rather expensive, and this could not be done in every city. So Moscow, despite building its metro first in 1935, they had one line, but then it would expand to a massive system with circles upon circles of lines and intersecting lines. It's basically you spend more time in a subway in Moscow than you do on the ground, just to say. And it would take 2 decades for another city to contain a metro system in the Soviet Union, because further construction and planning for another metro system would be difficult to do because something happened in the late 1930s. Aurora, do you know what that is?
Nope, haven't a clue.
Well, have you heard of the Great Patriotic War?
Oh, of course, right. Yeah, yes.
Yes, World War II is not a thing. It's a Great Patriotic War. So this would take place, and in a few years, 2 decades after this, in 1955, the next line would be built in Leningrad, now known as St. Petersburg, and would finally be followed by the Kievan metro system. These were the three cities that were chosen for one reason and one reason only. Do you know why, Aurora?
Bomb shelters.
We'll get to that. But no, these were the only three cities that had over a million people in the city and actually fit the parameter for building a metro system after the Great Patriotic War ended.
Oh, so
However,
the only ones that had enough people for them to justify the spending of doing a subway.
exactly, because they're like, well, we need to move massive amounts of people, so we're not going to do it in the cities that need to move massive amounts of people. So those were the main three cities: Moscow, St. Petersburg, and Kiev. But of course, we need to get to a fourth metro system, and that would be the Tbilisi Metro. However, we're not there yet, Ben. The thing about the Tbilisi Metro is that it is one of the few cities that had less than a million people, and it still got a metro before other places, such as Baku and Azerbaijan, which did have well over a million people at the time, thanks to its oil industry. So, how did that happen? That's thanks to one man, Vaso Bezhavanadze. Now you can switch the slide. And that is the man with his little Hitler stash.
What a beautiful choice of facial hair on this guy.
Oh my God, yes. So the important thing to know about Vasil Mijavanadze is that he is the first secretary of the Georgian Communist Party, which puts him in a very high place. And he would serve in that position until 1972. Anyways, the important thing to know about him is that he was a young man and he served as a political commissar during World War II. And after that, he'd become a deputy commander for political affairs in Kiev under the Ukrainian Communist Party leader, Nikita Khrushchev. Have you heard of that name?
We're going to be
Sounds
hearing more
familiar.
about him.
Yes. Well, Nikita Khrushchev will come in our future episode. And during this time in Kiev, there would sprout a working relationship between the two people. And after Stalin's death in 1953, Khrushchev supporters would purge the Georgian Communist Party that was led by Lavrenty Beria, that jerk. So Mijavanadze would soon be tapped to lead the Communist Party in Georgia, replacing Beria's protege. Oh, it's also important to note that Mijavanadze was also part of the anti-Khrushchev faction and would take actions to go against Khrushchev as much as possible. So we go back to 1952, and this is when construction would begin in Tbilisi for the metro systems, which would initiate the construction of the tunnels and the mountainous city. But Stalin's death would push orders from Moscow to liquidate the construction of the metro and throw ballast into the main mine on Liberty Square. These orders came directly from Khrushchev himself because he was like, Tbilisi did not hit the parameters of a million people. It only has 600,000 people, so no metro for you. And Mijanovic saw that as an issue because he wanted that metro system built, especially as there was already orders for one to be built in Kiev and Baku. Now, Kiev, he didn't mind as much because he worked there. But Baku, getting a metro system before Tbilisi, the Caucasian in him could not want that at all because Georgians would have to come out on top. So Mijavanadze would travel up to Moscow and talk to his old boss, Khrushchev, and they spoke in private, but curses could be heard coming from Khrushchev's office. And the order was given instead that Tbilisi's metro system should be preserved so that construction could resume at some point. Now, you can switch the slide. There are a few ideas of what could have happened in Moscow. According to Professor Abisalom Kudashvili, Mijavanadze's sister-in-law was married to Khrushchev, and during a dinner, he convinced Khrushchev to continue building the metro. But there's no way that that is true, seeing that Mijavanadze was married to a different Ukrainian woman. And another chain of thought is that the more official story is that Mijavanadze managed to persuade Khrushchev to build the metro system as a line of civilian defense. Since the tunnels were already there, it made sense to complete the metro system, and this was a great plan, especially since it somehow convinced Khrushchev to allow the construction of the Tbilisi Metro to continue. Now, let's take a look at the concept of metros as a civilian defense system. Next up, Ben. This goes back to the Great Patriotic War, when the Soviets would move their civilians down into the subway in response to German air raids, especially during the Siege of Moscow. They even served as offices for the council ministers during the war, and gave a good defense since the Soviets built their metros quite deep into the ground to ensure that they would not be penetrated by bombs. Now, this was made the standard in 1955 in Leningrad in the case of a capitalist invasion. So, and they continued with this as tradition in the metro systems in Moscow and the Soviet Union up to the modern day. Now, to finish off the construction of the metro, after Khrushchev was deposed in 1964, construction still continued because it was designated as a bomb shelter for Tbilisi, and would then be opened in 1966. This was primarily still used as a metro system, but due to Mijavanadze's convincing of Khrushchev, systems were able to be put in place to make it a good civil defense station, and as of today, can hold roughly 60-65% of the population of Tbilisi within it quite easily. Now, that's a bit about Mijavanadze, who would then be forced to retire in 1972 due to intense corruption. And honestly, if the Soviets are kicking you out for corruption, you were quite corrupt. And that's what we usually say on the show. Isn't that right, Aurora?
Yeah, like, if the Chronicles take the time to call you corrupt, that means you were doing above and beyond the normal obscene amounts of corruption.
Yes. So, anyways, that's basically all we have about this. Let's take it over to Ben. You can take over now, Ben. We'll be quiet.
All right. Great. So, for time reasons, I'm going to be trying to be quick about this. But Soviet urbanism in the West kind of has a pretty poor reputation. Interestingly, I think over the course of my career, this has been it's starting to get reassessed. I will say that nothing in what I'm about to say should be taken as an approval of the Soviet Union necessarily as a political system, or the power dynamics that allowed the kind of urbanism that we're going to be talking about. But just from a design standpoint, how did Soviet urbanism compare to Western examples? Just to address the reputational issues, it's been called cold, utilitarian, and ugly, this big concrete block construction that Roberto mentioned before. The problem with this is that a lot of this reputation was started when the first Western observers got to Eastern Europe in the immediate post-Cold War era. And in the middle of massive economic depressions and all sorts of problems. And a lot of the criticisms that I've seen in retrospect, there's a quote in Balkan Ghosts, and I meant to add it to the notes, but I forgot. But basically, it's something like, this guy's looking at these buildings, and they all have flower boxes, but it's depressing because they're all growing food. And it's like, first of all, nowadays in the West, lots of people grow food, but also it's like, well, I mean, they're having a depression. Anyway, so let's take a look at it from the beginning. From a theoretical basis, what are the sort of streams of thought that contributed to Soviet urbanism? Big thing, tenements and mills of the 19th century, the sort of industrial revolutionary satanic mills that sort of created communism to begin with. Everyone, even Western capitalist observers, thought that these were a problem, that tenements were not safe for human habitation and something should be done about it. One of the first people to start talking about what to do about it were the utopian socialists. Marx would end up coming down hard on them, but they were sort of still part of the larger oeuvre of socialism and communism. And so it was thinking that people learned about, and so some of their ideas made their way into the larger mental space. Urban planning theorists, just more generally, were all sort of drawing from the same well. So Western ideas about garden cities or the City Beautiful movement in the United States were things that people in the Soviet Union thought about and learned about and read about, then looked at through their own ideological perspective. With the main point being that cities, these theorists liked things like single-use districts, bringing lots of greenery into cities to beautify them, things like that. And then, of course, there's the Soviet ideology that you want your city to be classless and provide a, be good for workers and all things like that. So, Soviet urbanism went through some distinct phases based on what was going on. And I'm not going to read through all this in detail, but so in the revolutionary period, they were very busy fighting the civil war and staying alive as a country. So there wasn't a whole lot that was happening then. During the industrialization period, which you could also call the Stalinist period, the main preoccupation was getting the country ready for a war with the capitalist West and then fighting World War II and then recovering from World War II. So the outlays of resources in that period were building heavy industry and maybe, you'd build worker housing because you needed to, because you needed workers, but it was there was one decision but made by the government that every worker was allowed 100 square feet of living space, which even by Manhattan standards is pretty tight quarters, especially when you have to share it with your family. So once you get into the 1950s, we were out of the Soviet Union's out of the emergency. The cities that have been destroyed have at least had their city centers rebuilt. And it's time, there's a recognition, especially under Khrushchev, that, if we're going to make this Soviet Union thing work, it needs to work on its own and not just be hopping from crisis to crisis. We need to actually start addressing standard of living issues, quality of life issues. So they made the decision to start investing in housing. As part of that effort, though, and in line with their Soviet principles, they made the decision to disown and disavow all decoration and go for utilitarian modernist styles to ensure efficient housing for all and embrace things like prefabricated construction techniques. This was, again, in line with sort of the internationalist modernist style, especially of the pre-war period. And the idea of using modern materials to give good standards of living and design for the masses was not restricted to the Soviet Union. Now, the
I
most
was going to say, because
famous.
wasn't there a little crossover? Because I'm pretty sure
Yeah.
all the dorms I lived in college were built exactly like those block apartments.
Yeah.
Like a lot of state universities built their dorms in exactly the same style.
Yes. Yeah. And there was definitely one of the things is that this style sort of stands out more in the Soviet Union. It was the official style, and it was sort of like the only thing that was getting funding. And in the West, there's just a lot of different styles going on because it's not just governments and institutions. Institutions really like the modern style for resource reasons. Like we've got a fancy artsy reason to justify not spending money on decoration. Neat.
The University of Wisconsin system loved those undecorated block apartment towers, let me tell you what.
So the Khrushchevka is sort of the thing that people think of when they think of Soviet urbanism, although it was updated a decade or two into the Brezhnevka, which is more of the taller ones.
I do want to interlude and say that there is a running joke in the Soviet Union that because these are all prefabricated, that and all the street names are the same, you can go into one house in St. Petersburg and one house in Moscow, and the key would work the same, and like the street name would be the same, the apartment number would be the same, and the keys would just be similar. And there's a
Right.
whole movie that they show every New Year's that is about this premise, and people fall in love because of that. So
Right.
it's a nice joke. Just want.
Also, I just got to say, this looks like a slightly older version of the now popular 5-over-1 that we have all over in the US.
Yeah. And again, there's reasons for that that have to do with actually the way these things are built. So the prefabricated concrete panel construction, especially at the time, there was only so big a span you could cross with the panel. A lot of that's been overcome now in modern prefab construction. They're actually doing some really cool stuff with prefab construction now. But at the time, so you can see in this picture the little the red squares, essentially. Each one of those red squares was manufactured at a central factory in Moscow and shipped out to wherever they were building the building, and they bolted them together like a giant erector set. There were some pluses and minuses to this. Obviously, it's cheap. It's super cheap. You get a ton of, the overhead costs are less if you're making everything in one place. Downside is that you could only span so much space, so you couldn't use this to make like a factory or a grocery store or something like that. It had to be retail, sorry, it had to be residential and relatively small scale retail, which was fine given what they were trying to do. There also have been some quality issues over the years. But I think one thing to point out is in terms of what the amount of space and living standards that you got, given the time periods, it was fairly fine in terms of space. It's not nothing in ter nothing to do with like American McMansions or anything like that, for the upper classes of the United States. But up until well, even my house technically right now is a 900 square foot house. I think having a and for a three bedroom house, having around 1,000 square feet for four bedrooms is a completely reasonable amount of living space for a family even now in the United States. So I think that this is competitive, put it that way. Also, each building was intended to be part of a larger fabric, and part of that fabric was that each building had a yard with amenities. Sometimes it was a playground, sometimes it was a garden, something along those lines. Oh, and I kept trying to say this before. Khrushchevka is named after Khrushchev, and Brezhnevka is named after Brezhnev, the leaders of the Soviet Union at the time that these things were designed. So, since you couldn't put bigger industrial uses in these buildings, each of the non-residential buildings would be a custom job by the Soviet architects, and they actually kind of were able to sort of go nuts on them.
Those all look so good. I'm sorry.
They
Okay,
do.
I do like these. Yeah, especially
And
the
so
top one.
these are in Tbilisi. The top one is a wedding venue, because the Soviet Union, you didn't have you weren't supposed to go to churches to get married. So this was an all-encompassing wedding venue. Not only was there like a big space for the reception and the ceremony, it had a tailor and like a caterer all in there, so you could come in with your family and pick out your suit and your dress and make catering decisions and all, arrange all that stuff. And then you're just one-stop shopping for your wedding.
Oh,
The
Ben, 15 minutes.
yeah. Okay. The bottom building, is the old highway department in Tbilisi. So these are both in Tbilisi and they're both pretty cool. So, a lot of the criticism of Soviet, urbanism is in the sameness of it, which is fair in terms of the Khrushchevkas, but it should be understood that the non-residential buildings were pretty free form.
I was wondering if I recognized those pictures.
So there's other things than buildings in a city in an urban fabric. One thing that you so this is theory, and I should say that in terms of the success of Soviet urbanism in any particular city, that has to be analyzed on a one-to-one basis. But in terms of the plans that they had, the idea was that these cities should have like up to 50% open space, and that's when you count the yards around the buildings, the dedicated parks, the public plazas, areas around schools and things like that. But that's still pretty, again, that's pretty impressive amount of open space, and it's in line with what Americans try and go for these days. And so, oops. Okay, the larger planned fabric, the city was sort of organized into these residential, well, so it was residential blocks, commercial areas, industrial areas, all connected by a hierarchy of roads and public transportation. And like I said before, in each of these blocks, it was sort of a single-use block. This is the residential area, and there's not much there other than residential. This is the industrial area. That's where everyone goes to work. This is the commercial area. And in theory, anyone could get an apartment by applying to local authorities. Anyone who knows anything about the Soviet Union and knows that it always helped to know someone. In terms of whether you got or not you actually got an apartment when you asked for one and how long it took. But all of which is to say that this is in line with what Western cities were trying to do. If you look at zoning in suburban areas, there'll be residential zones and commercial zones and industrial zones, and everyone has to travel between them using a hierarchy of roads. On the plus side, millions and millions of housing units were constructed, and it seriously raised the standard of living for people in the Soviet Union. There's sort of no way around that. Granted, part of that's because things were so awful before, but little or no power was given to local authorities to adapt to local conditions, which led to a lot of waste. The Soviet Union now is somewhat notorious for their unfortunate pollution. Impacts, and that certain housing certainly contributed to that. Mono-use districts in planning circles are now seen as a real problem, because you have to travel more. If your school is in your neighborhood, you don't have to travel as far as if you had put the school in a central government district and you have to travel to the other side of the city. Similarly, if you know your workplace is can be anywhere in the city, you don't have to all travel to one place. You know, there's less travel there. So the fact that metros ended up being such an important part of Soviet cities was because of this, because they were accidentally sort of planning in a lot of extra travel that wasn't necessarily necessary. And this is, to be fair, this is an issue in the US too. The whole suburban zone thing is a real problem. The quality of the construction was mixed at best, especially with the Khrushchevkas. Some of them were intended to be temporary or like proofs of concept. So in Moscow, they're basically going through and nuking all the Khrushchevkas and replacing them with updated apartment block designs. As far as the aesthetics, yeah, they were all very samey and you know, impersonal. However, so are things in the West. Levittown is remarkably ugly if you've ever been there. Suburban lots are, you know, developers come in and they build the same house over and over and over again using mass production techniques, except they just do them in the field instead of in a factory. And it's designed around individual separated home ownership, which is again driven by government policy and not by the market necessarily because of New Deal era loan policies. So the whole Garden City ideology is still with us. It's with us in terms of whether you have a standalone house with its own little park or a giant apartment block with its own little park. They're sort of doing the same thing, just in slightly different ways. What you prefer, maybe just down to taste. Which isn't to say that there weren't real problems with quality and pollution with the Soviet patterns of building, but you know. Levittowns, when they were originally built, they weren't hooked up to sewer systems. They had cesspits under each house. They didn't even have septic systems. Like, there's real ramifications for design choices for all these places. And it's sort of just what you're used to. All right, questions.
Thank you, Spasiba. In his final days, Alexander the Great's generals asked him who should succeed him. Alexander's answer, the strongest. Taken literally, this would see the close of the classical Greek age, an age thousands of years in the making. Join me, Mark Selleck, as I go back to retell the story of ancient Greece in my series Casting Through Ancient Greece. We will cast our way back to its beginnings, all the way through to the spread of its culture throughout the known world.
thanks to Alexander and his generals. You can listen and subscribe to the series at www.castingthroughancientgreece.com, or you can listen on your favourite podcasting platform. Don't forget to follow the series over on Twitter at Casting Greece or on Facebook at Casting Through Ancient Greece. I look forward to seeing you there.
Hello and bonjour. My name is Josh Zucker, and I want to take you on a journey through some of the most exciting events of the late Middle Ages. Valois Burgundy was one of the medieval world's greatest what-ifs. Its dukes inherited, conquered, and politicked their way into forging a state between the German Empire and the Kingdom of France that rivaled them both. From the Hundred Years' War to the Holy Roman Empire, from urban workers to Joan of Arc, and from gallant knights to gunpowder weapons, the Grand Dukes of the West had a part to play in almost all of Western Europe's biggest developments in the 14th and 15th centuries. If you want to learn more about the glamorous rise and dramatic fall of the Dukes of Burgundy, please join me for Grand Dukes of the West, A History of Valois Burgundy.
Oh, awesome. Well, everyone, now the presentation. We have about 10 minutes left in the session, but if you do have any questions, please feel free to put them in the chat or raise your hand in the bottom center of your screen. With that, I kind of have one that's kind of off the top of my head. And maybe this is like the whole point of the presentation, but like, why do you have a really good looking subway station, and then you go up out to the outdoors, and then it's gray blah everywhere?
Okay, so here's the reasoning: you're going to spend more time traveling in the subway system than you're going to be outside, because it's Moscow, it's cold, it's rainy. It sucks to be outside. It's polluted. Inside the subway system, the air is nicer. It's filtered. And plus, it's like there was a shift in mentality and then resource usage at some point in the Soviet Union where they're like, oh, we have to make the outside look just like useful. And we can concentrate the art within the metro system. But because they did this, you know, the beautiful metro in Moscow, Leningrad, and Kiev, they're like, well, we have to keep tradition going. But, like, they didn't want to use the resources because they would have to use way more resources above ground than they would underground to make it beautiful, to make things beautiful. And it's easier to, like, update stuff underground.
And it should be said that there's a major ideological component driving most of this stuff, where the goal, at least, you know, according to the theorists, the goal of urbanism is to provide, you know, people a good standard of living, but also to glorify the state. And, you know, Soviet ideology and drive that forward. And so train stations, if you go back to that period, train stations were a way to have monumental, beautiful spaces in urban areas. You know, Grand Central in New York, places like that. Train stations are supposed to be epic and beautiful and a place for public art. And then, you know, you walk around the tenements of New York City in the 1950s to the 1980s, you know, it's kind of crap.
Well, from an ideological perspective, that goes along with when you pointed out those, like, the public buildings, like the highway authority or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, your personal apartment isn't supposed to be that great. You're supposed to be glorifying, again, the government, the workers, state, right? So it should be these public buildings in the public areas that are the ones that are the most glorious, most beautiful to look at.
Right.
So you go to work in this giant, beautiful building and drive through your commerce through your giant, beautiful subway to your little block apartment to remind you that you are just a little block.
And it should also be said that you were allowed to decorate the inside however you wanted. And
and
some of them were like,
they're gorgeous inside.
Yeah, they were gorgeous inside. I mean, depending on what you did as an individual, but there's example blocks. Unfortunately, I didn't. I had one in one slide, but I had to delete it for time. But there's an example Khrushchevka flat at one of the museums in Poland, I think. That's very nice. It looks nice. And that's actually true for like New York City tenements, too, a lot of times. If you weren't in the worst of the worst, like slumlord awful tenement, you'd come to this building and you know, there'd be trash in the hallways. Everyone's sharing a bathroom, but then you'd go into the family room and they'd have a little piano. They'd have a table. They'd have, you know, family heirlooms in a glass-fronted case. You know, people like to make their own spaces nice. So for what they have control of, they would do that. And one last thing in terms of the public spaces, I didn't quite talk about this in the thing, but parks, like I said, were a huge part of this. Mm-hmm. And the design of the parks, the landscape architecture of this was very monumental. It was all about having these huge spaces where you could have crowds gather and hold up signs and support the Soviet state, etc.
Yeah, I saw a question from Josh, and basically asking, what was Mijavanadze doing that was so corrupt? So what Mijavanadze was doing was, he was a Beria ally, and at that time it was the Brezhnev era, and Brezhnev did not want any like holder-ons, and especially like just doing things in TV. So the thing is, in the Soviet Union, we don't get much information about what corruption these people were doing, so we can assume it was just massively stealing from the state, and got caught stealing. And that's probably what the issue was. So, and probably Brezhnev just didn't like him. He was, Mijavanadze is a horrible person, and he probably just wanted to put in his own like guy. And at this point, like, Mijavanadze was like in his like early 70s, late 60s. So it's like, he's getting old. Of course, Brezhnev was pretty freaking old too. But yeah, it was like, I want my guy down there. I don't want, you know, Beria's guy. Because, like, yeah, nobody likes Beria.
No, you shouldn't. But, like, everyone was doing bribery and graft.
Right.
That's, like, the point of being in the bureaucracy, is so you can do graft and bribery and get rich. That's, like, the whole point. It just, if you're doing too much of it, you can get caught. Or if, you're not on the side of the guy who's in charge now, they can very conveniently just charge you with that because everyone's doing it.
Yeah. Oh, wow, my pearls, look at all this corruption.
Oh!
Oh dear. I've but never also, seen anything like that.
But also, it was a time period where, like, things were not looking great. It was, like, the early 70s, so, like, Russia was starting to go, and like, hey, we should change the economic system. So, like, they brought in different people to shake things up, younger blood, and that's, you know, they brought in Eduard Shevardnadze, who ends up becoming one of, like, the de facto leaders of Georgia once it becomes a republic. So there's a few people, like, that are trying to start changing things from the inside, and that's what ends up happening. Mm-hmm. You know, Shevardnadze was just very, like, out and, like, yeah, I'm stealing, I don't care. But you can learn more about him once you get to him in several decades in the history of Sacramento, Georgia, because he's going to be a major proponent as the Georgian leader.
All right. Well, we have about 2 minutes left in the session, so unless anybody has a really quick question, I think this might be coming to the end of our time here. So thank you, Ben and Aurora and Roberto, for presenting with us today. There are sessions going on all day long. There's another session coming in about 5 minutes, so please keep checking those out, and thank you guys for your time today.
All right.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye.
History of Persia fans, before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conqueror's Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.